Thank you very much for Pastor and Minister McAfee. For those of you who don't know her, she has made an extraordinary contribution to Ireland's planning for negotiation of Brexit. We work very closely together. On lots of levels, to maintain EU solidarity and try to communicate a clear and reasonable and respectful view to the UK in terms of Ireland's position on Brexit and why Irish vulnerabilities are at the heart of trying to find a way to get a deal done here that allows everybody to move forward. And I just thank Loretta. The generosity to Ireland just has no end. Yet again, hosting us here this morning in this beautiful location. So thank you for all you continue to do for the where we're at in the context of two issues. One, Brexit, two, politics of Northern Ireland. I know this is an audience that cares a lot about the island of Ireland as a whole, relationships on that island, a peace process that has done extraordinary things in the last 21 years, and trying to protect that through the current storms and controversies that we're trying to navigate. So I'll be blunt, if you don't mind. And I hope that the journalists here will respect that and cover it in a way that's accurate and appropriate. First of all, on Brexit. This has been a journey for Ireland where initially I think there was disbelief at the decision to leave the European Union of the United Kingdom. But we have moved way beyond that now into accepting that decision, of course, because it was done democratically, but maintaining a consistent negotiating position that is based on, one, respecting the decision in the UK, two, insisting on protecting a peace process through delivery of that decision, insisting on ensuring that as a consequence of Brexit, Ireland as an island doesn't have to reimpose border infrastructure, creating both trade barriers but also the politically corrosive impact of physical barriers again on trade in the island of Ireland. We have been focusing on ensuring that Ireland maintains its place in the European Union. As importantly, in the EU single market and customs union, which is really the basis for a successful Irish economy and has been for decades now. Also trying to protect the British-Irish relationship, which has been, as many of you will know, a complex and at times a tragic one, but certainly for the last two decades has been experiencing a stronger and more positive relationship than ever before. And those relationships, of course, have come under some strain in the context of trying to find answers to Brexit. And so we spent 2 years negotiating the detail of all of that. We were negotiating through the EU negotiating team led by Michel Barnier and his task force, a group of really organised and really smart people who have taken the time to really understand the Irish concerns and vulnerabilities and have insisted on answers in the context of trying to resolve those questions through negotiation. And that culminated in, I can give you a long history lesson here in terms of the staging of agreements of principle in writing and in legal text. But essentially, that culminated in a withdrawal agreement that was agreed to and endorsed by 28 governments across the European Union, including the British government. And we had a vote in the Irish Dáil on this issue, and had almost unanimous support for it. And so that was and is the starting position for us. The fact that that withdrawal agreement couldn't get endorsed or ratified from the British Parliament has resulted in, quite frankly, political chaos in the British system, whereby Theresa May tried three times to get that withdrawal agreement ratified and couldn't. Ultimately, it ended in the end of her premiership to be replaced by Boris Johnson, who unfortunately has essentially tried to rewrite the challenge of Brexit in the context of the Irish issues that we've talked about generally, to such an extent that that we are now at an impasse. Because what he has said is that he could accept the withdrawal agreement with the exception of the solution to the Irish issue. There are only four issues that are really dealt with in the withdrawal agreement. There's citizens' rights. There's about 3 million EU citizens living in the UK. And there's a lot of British citizens living across the EU. And their future needs certainty. When they stay in the UK, do the work permit, and they leave, if they leave, and they come back, and family members join them, what is their status? Those issues are largely resolved in the withdrawal agreement to everybody's satisfaction. The second issue is the financial settlement. Britain committed to contributing to EU budgets until the end of 2021. That means they still contribute about 40 billion euros. Without that money, there's a huge hole in EU budgets. That issue has been largely resolved. Resolved because of the third issue that also got resolved, which is really important for business, which is what's called the agreement on a transition period. So when Britain leaves, we simply move into a new phase. Britain is out of the European Union, but essentially all the rules and regulations of the EU continue to apply to the UK, which allows for free flow of trade if they were a member for at least 2 years, with an option to extend that to 4 years if Britain wants, to create the time and space to negotiate the future relationship in terms of trade, security, data management, fishing, and a dozen other things. And that withdrawal, that transition arrangement in law is hugely important for businesses that will have to take, that will need the time to adapt to a new trading environment and new realities in terms of the relationship between the UK and the EU. And then the fourth issue is Ireland. And part of the Irish protocol is what's called, or now known as, the backstop. And what the backstop is essentially, it's an agreement between the EU and the UK which says, if all else fails, we've got a fallback position. In other words, if we can't negotiate a future relationship that doesn't require border infrastructure, well then the default position will be that Northern Ireland will remain aligned in terms of regulation with the rules of the EU customs union single market to prevent the need for border destruction. And that will be a temporary arrangement until we find a way of solving it more permanently. And that was the guarantee and the reassurance that we sought and got from this process so that I could look people in the eye, in Uri, in Belfast, and in Derry, or in counties south of the border, and say to them, no matter what happens here, you're not going to face border infrastructure as a reality again, where goods would have to be checked in warehouses, where tariffs would have to be paid, where customs officials would be stopping bags and checking them in cameras and all the rest of it. And that has been our red line, and still is. And so what we have said to Prime Minister Johnson is, if his approach is that he can support the withdrawal agreement without the backstop, well then the onus is on him to answer the question, how do we solve the Irish border question? Because to be perfectly honest with you, whether the backstop does it or something else that has the same result as the backstop doesn't really bother the Irish government. Our position is we need a solution to this question. And because if we don't, what we are doing is we are transferring a problem that at the moment doesn't seem to be solvable in Westminster to Ireland for the future. And we become the collateral damage of Brexit in the context of the Irish border question dominating Irish politics for the foreseeable future, taking us in a very uncertain direction, politically, north and south, and the Irish part. And I believe that the British government has a responsibility, as we do, as co-guarantors of the Israeli agreement, to ensure that doesn't happen. And so what we've said is, if you want the backstop out of the withdrawal agreement, but you tell us what you're going to put into the withdrawal agreement to solve that problem. And that is surely not an unreasonable request. And unfortunately, there has been no credible answer to that question. And so we have said, the backstop's got to stay until you come up with an alternative arrangement that can do the same thing. And there has been a lot of fanciful discussion and proposals coming forward around alternative arrangements on the basis of technology, cameras, trusted trader schemes. But to be honest with you, when you test these answers, they're essentially borders waiting for. Let's just be. And what Prime Minister Johnson has tried to do is reframe the challenge here from being no border infrastructure or related checks or controls and the protection of the all-island economy, which is the commitment, to no physical border infrastructure on the border. In other words, do the checks for us. But unfortunately, they still have the effect of fundamentally frustrating trade on the island of Ireland, and in some cases, probably ending it. Think about this for a second, because this is actually about more than trade. It's about identity. It's about people who signed up to a peace agreement which changed our constitution in Ireland to no longer stake claim to Northern Ireland in return for the institutions and the agreement in the Good Friday Agreement, which essentially was about convergence between North and South, respecting that Northern Ireland was part of the Kingdom, but at the same time insisted on North-South cooperation to such an extent that the border would largely become invisible, which is exactly what's happened. The problem with Brexit, of course, and in particular Prime Minister Johnson's version of Brexit, is that it's all about divergence. And that is why it runs in fundamental conflict to the Good Friday Agreement, which is about bringing people together, which is about shared rules and regulations in the context of joint EU membership, and therefore making North-South cooperation and structures that provide that easily known. If your intent in Brexit, which has been outlined in a letter to President Tusk from Boris Johnson, your intent is to diverge from EU regulation, to move away from level playing field commitments in terms of economic management in the United Kingdom, including Northern Ireland. Well, then, effectively, what has happened with a change of government or a change of Prime Minister in the UK is that they have removed the solution, or they're asking to remove the solution to the Irish border question. And they're creating a much bigger problem to solve in the context of the Irish question by saying, well, this is a backstop. Oh, and by the way, we want to fundamentally diverge away from EU rules and regulations and other things. And so if you have two single markets next door to each other, operating to different rules, you have to have a border infrastructure. Otherwise, you fundamentally undermine the functioning and the integrity of both of those markets. Because you don't know what's coming and going and where it's come from and what rules and regulations apply to its production. And so we are confronting the British government with these realities. And we will not sign a Brexit deal unless these realities are recognised and solutions are put in place as well. And that is... We really want a deal. We will work towards trying to find a way of getting a deal. A no deal is a disaster for Ireland. We know that. We have put a huge amount of work into putting contingency plans in place to try to manage that. I think we can do a reasonably good job in many, many areas. We're spending hundreds of millions of euros of Irish taxpayers' money to prepare for that. So when people look at me from the UK and say, you know, we're frustrated that the Irish aren't showing more flexibility, and, you know, it's the Irish that should be frustrated. We're spending a huge amount of our own money and a huge amount of our time and effort and political currency across the European Union trying to solve a problem that is not of our making, and that we disagree with and don't see the sense of, but respect because it was made democratically. But the least I think we can expect is a facilitation that is consistent with the challenge that we face. And so there's a deal to be done. And this idea that there is no deal there, that it's impossible to do, is nonsense. There are solutions to this, but it's a matter of political will. And the expectation that somehow Ireland will, at the very end of this process, because of the consequences of the no deal for Ireland, that we'll suddenly get weakly and essentially agree to some kind of halfway house, is a fundamental misreading of the Irish mindset on this issue. And so we want an honest solution to a difficult and complex problem that allows Brexit to move ahead, that protects the unique relationships on the island of Ireland, because Northern Ireland is not the same as the rest of the United Kingdom. Yes, it's part of the United Kingdom, we respect that, but it's different in so many other ways, and it needs a unique solution to protect that difference. And I think most people in this room understand that only too well. I won't take this on the next topic. It's Northern Ireland and the lack of devolved institutions there. Quite frankly, this keeps me up at night. Thinking about how we can find a way to create a platform that can allow parts to work together. I think we can do that. I think all of the parties want to be back into functioning devolved institutions. But I think they're really focused about how they can deal with the consequences of Brexit in the context of those devolved institutions if they get up and running again. There's a whole range of other domestic political considerations that we've been working through with the parties for many, many weeks now. But I would say that I think all party leaders, with no exception, in Northern Ireland, want to try to make that work. And all I'd say is that I think there's a big onus on the governments to try and provide joint leadership and togetherness between the two governments to lay that platform out, to work with the parties to do that, and to make it as easy as possible for them to make that jump back into committing to politics, working together to try to solve problems in Northern Ireland. And believe me, the list of issues that require political decision making in Northern Ireland is now very, very, very long. And the idea that a no deal Brexit could happen, and it could, I believe we can avoid it, but it could happen. The idea that Northern Ireland would not have devolved government, would not have political leadership installed while trying to deal with the consequences of a no deal Brexit, which for Northern Ireland, let's not forget, we've got a direct warning. Forget about what I say. I have very strong views about the damage that would be done in Northern Ireland if there was a no deal. But listen to the PSNI in terms of their concerns around social unrest. Listen to senior civil servants in Northern Ireland that talk about possibly losing 40,000 jobs in Northern Ireland. For those of you who know Northern Ireland and its economic structure, its reliance on public sector work, and the number of people that are employed in the private sector, you take 40,000 away from that, and you'll get a dramatic negative impact in terms of the well-being of Northern Ireland. And we all have a responsibility to try and make sure that doesn't happen. But the idea that that would happen without any governance, Northern Ireland effectively being rudderless, with the British government attempting to effectively shift towards some form of direction, because they would have to try to make some decisions in Northern Ireland. And the impact that that would have, particularly on nationalism, but also in these communities and communities that need it. You know, and you're into a very unstable space. So we need to make sure that doesn't happen. Parties in Northern Ireland have an obligation to make sure that they are working together and seem to be working together in Stormont, in a functioning assembly and executive again, hopefully an all-party executive. And we need to, as governments, I have to say, the new Secretary for Northern Ireland, in my view, is a great guy. And as has his predecessor been, by the way. I have a very good relationship with Julian Smith. I think he understands the complexity of Northern Ireland really well, and is determined to try to find answers with me that can be supported by the Unionist parties and Nationalist parties and the Alliance of Greens and so on. So look, this is a time that I've described as a moment where history is being written as we speak. What happens over the next few weeks may well determine relationships in the island of Ireland for the next 20 or 30 years. They will certainly determine relationships between the EU and the UK, potentially for a lifetime. So we better get it right. And the place to start when you're being asked to make huge decisions that may involve compromise and flexibility is telling people the truth and not dismissing what are real concerns and fears as some kind of project fear for political reasons. The Irish government has no alternative agenda here except to try to maintain stability and calm in the Isle of Ireland, try to minimise the disruptive impact of Brexit while respecting the UK's position as a whole. That's our agenda. And that will continue to be our agenda as people try to raise the pressure in the context of trying to force compromise over the next few weeks. And of course try to sort of kick problems down the road as we can't solve them now. Now is the time to deal with the Irish border question. And not saying, look, we'll deal with it during the future negotiations. I'm sure that we'll find a way if we all have endeavour and generosity. If we're all pulling in the same direction, but that kind of talk is not, now is the time to face up to the complexity and realities of Brexit from an Irish perspective, because the British Prime Minister has chosen to make the Irish issue the issue that he wants to change in terms of the approach of the withdrawal agreement. And so our response to that has been, okay, we respect that, but you've got to answer the question in terms of how you do that. And I think if we can answer those questions, I believe that 12 institutions in Northern Ireland can happen and last in a sustainable way. And we need to be careful not to link the two issues too much, if they are separate issues. I think it would be naive not to accept that they are connected in the context of the polarisation effects of Brexit and the fears, and they're genuine fears. And I would say that the battle for the unionism, I can understand the fears of unionism linked to Brexit. The sense that decisions are being made for Northern Ireland that they don't fully control, that alignment with the EU may well represent for some a move away from UK or regulation in Great Britain. And they want to understand how that's going to work, or they can't accept it at all, depending on the perspective. But you've got to understand the fears of nationalism too. The idea that actually economic barriers could be reimposed, effectively creating a more definitive economic partition of the island. Even that language is a motive. So these are big tests for an Irish government, for a teacher who needs to make the right judgment calls. And he needs people like me and others around them making sure that we take the right risks here. Because we have a lot of people's lives and livelihoods that are linked to that we have a responsibility for. And one of the reasons why I wanted to meet all of you this morning is that I know you care about those lives and livelihoods. And whenever I come to New York or to Washington, it's important. point that I reach out and talk very bluntly to try to give an understanding of the choices that we have to make on your behalf and on behalf of some of the other Irish people through these strange times. I make a point of not commenting on what's happening in the internal British political system in terms of court cases, in terms of prorogation. These are all issues for the UK to resolve. Our issue is the impact on Ireland and on the island of Ireland and Brexit, and we need answers. But we have answers that work, and if we're going to move away from those positions, we need to be convinced that the alternatives to those work too. As I said, I think that is a reasonable position, and it is going to be an extremely stubborn position, I'm sure, in terms of ensuring that we get an outcome that's fair to Ireland that respects the UK's decision. So hopefully that gives you a sense of of where we're at. Also a big focus for this week, but I know most of you are here to try to understand the Brexit challenge and the choices that the Irish government is faced with here. I'm glad to say that we have had extraordinary solidarity in the context of these challenges across the European Union. There's a reason why EU membership now is 93% support from the Irish people. It has 98% support amongst Irish people in 2025. Basically, every young person wants Ireland to be part of the European Union now. And that has been because, I think, of the solidarity that we have got at a time of real vulnerability and exposure in the context of our island, which needs to be protected. I think Helen's going to come up now. We're going to take questions if you have. Feel free to be as it comes as a rare. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul, Sharon. Thank you, Minister. Actually, we're going to reconfigure here and take away the podium. As Loretta, first of all, thank you again to Loretta for hosting us this morning. As Loretta said, the trust asked meet all of you, because you are influencers across Irish America and across the United States. I spoke to a lot of you about Brexit, individually in small groups and groups like this over the last couple of years. But Thomas, I put far more pleasure than I'm going to. You've heard a lot from the monkey, but now you can hear from the organ grinder. Meet the monkey, Thomas. And when we issued the invitation, we didn't know that we'd also be fortunate enough to have Ireland's Minister of European Affairs, Salamanti, here also, who has just crisscrossed every European country, and how many times the Minister has been in every European capital. I'm going to emcee the questions just because I know some of you here, and also have the Minister and the Taoiseach, our time pressure, so we would never let them go. But with that, we'd love to take questions from the floor. Ted Smith, unsurprisingly, has the first question.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Taoiseach. Thank you, Thomas, for that very eloquent and candid assessment of where we are right now. And I can't tell you how proud we are in the Irish nation abroad of what you and the Taoiseach and the Minister have done to pull together all our European countries in support of peace in Ireland and keeping the border open. It's an unprecedented time in the history of Ireland. And this government has done an extraordinary job together with the Irish diplomats to work really hard on. And I want to say you're 100% correct when you say this audience cares, this Irish American audience. And we don't just care, we want to know what we can do to help. So I guess my question to you is, what can we do to keep this going? You're very busy in Europe, and rightly so, but we feel that not just Chairman Neal was going to do great things and Speaker Pelosi, but the Irish American community wants to help. It's helped over the last 21 years, over the last 50 years in the Irish peace process. There's very unfinished business to the Good Friday Agreement in terms of reconciliation in Northern Ireland. There are great divisions. And what can we do beyond, it's a very helpful meeting to do more for the process. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's A very good question. I always get asked it every time I come. I mean, what's amazing about Irish America is that, you know, they offer their sort of support in terms of approach, and then they say, so what? Tell me what to do now. What do you need? And whether that's Richie Neal or any one of a number of very influential political leaders who really understand Ireland well, or whether it's business people here or the Irish community and the networks here. I mean, what I'd say is that keep the conversation going here, particularly with influencers in Washington. We are not asking the US to take sides. Let's just be clear on that. You know, the President Trump's position is that he supports Brexit. That's fine. Many don't, but he does. What we are asking the US to do, though, is to protect the peace process that the US is central to delivering. And so when I go to Washington, I say, look, we're not asking you to reverse Brexit or put pressure on the British government to change direction, but what we are asking you to do is watch carefully as to the impact of Brexit on the island of Ireland, and to insist that if you support Brexit and support British government in terms of trying to deliver it, that you take account of the Irish issues, particularly when we have agreed solutions to the Irish issues, and what's missing is the political will to follow through on those. And I think we've got a good hearing from the White House, as well as from many others, both in Congress and the Senate. And that is why I think that if the UK tries to press ahead in a way that results in a no deal, which will have, in my view, a very damaging impact on relationships in the island of Ireland, it will make the Devolved government much more difficult to maintain, and it will create a very, very difficult political management exercise, in my view, for both British and Irish governments in the context of Northern Ireland. And I think that, in many ways, you know, rocks the foundation of the Friday Agreement, quite frankly. And I don't say that lightly. You know, if you have no functioning executive or assembly, you therefore have no North South institutions, so there's no ministers to meet. If you have an attempt to shift to direct rule in London, the Irish government will not support that. And we will insist on having some consultative role in the context of how decisions are made. We obviously will have a big obligation to try to protect and maintain calm in Northern Ireland. But you know, these are things that should not happen and are unnecessary. And there is a way of avoiding, in the context of an existing withdrawal agreement. And so I think that, you know, raising these issues at political level, reminding our political leaders here that have Irish American connections of the ongoing role that the US has in protecting the peace process that it has a huge stake in and has had a huge involvement in delivering, I think is important. The other thing I'd say is that I would ask you to encourage political parties in Northern Ireland to work with the two governments if we take a new initiative in the coming weeks to try to re-establish the sector. I think Irish America does have influence that can help to give reassurance to parties that they're going to make decisions that involve political risk. All of this is about political risk in terms of choices. The easy thing to do is to lock yourself in a room, stick with your own political family, and essentially blame somebody else. And the whole point of the Good Friday Agreement is that it forces convergence, to use that word, and forces compromise and understanding of another community's and another political party's perspectives. And that's where we need to get back to again, as opposed to the kind of easy, polarized, slagging match that sometimes happens when the pressure comes on. And Irish America, as I say, particularly on the national side, I think has an influence over the appetite for risk within certain political parties, but I think maybe tested in the
in the weeks ahead.
Okay. To add reading to that, I think it's extremely important through that communication and that contact that Irish people at home as well know that the support is here. And Simon talked about the 92% to the 98% support Europe. That has been because not just our travelling to and our engagement with European colleagues, but they have taken the time to come to Ireland, to travel to the border, to meet with the community, and that's seen and that's understood. And I think your engagement here with the political parties, whether it's Nancy Pelosi or other groups who have travelled, who have come to Northern Ireland, who have met with people, who have shown that support, I think it's extremely important for people at home. I thought it's a very uncertain and unnerving and unsettling time, so that being at home as well as here is extremely helpful, that engagement and to continue that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When Nancy Pelosi's group came to Ireland, it had an extraordinary impact actually. On Irish people wanting to see solidarity on the other side of the Atlantic, because they know the power of that. One other thing as well is in terms of financial support through the Ireland Funds. Steve Bailey here, who leads the Ireland Funds now, and another many donors and supporters in Sweden too. And some people sometimes say to me, you know, the peace process not done? Is it not settled? What is the role now for funding programs for integration and reinforcing the peace and better community relationships and so on? Integrated education and so many of the other things that the Irish Funds have been so important to us. And I would say that they're as important now as they've ever been, arguably. Northern Ireland is in as fragile a place now as at any point in the last 20 years.
Thank you,
Conch Minister. Thank you for your leadership. As a member of the IEA's board, I've been fortunate to have a view of the extensive preparation work that your team and the agency have done, and it's highly commendable. But given that the US remains the single largest source of foreign direct investment in Ireland, how can this community bolster the message that Ireland Inc. is open for business despite what is the perceived instability and uncertainty?
But that's a very welcome question. It involves the positive answers that I talked about earlier. So the key message for Ireland in terms of contingency in a post-Brexit environment is that we're staying in the EU. With all of the certainty that brings, with all of the solidarity that brings, with all of the political and financial support that comes with that, with all of the access to the markets, to nearly half a billion people that comes with that, Ireland is going to be, while geographically an island outside an island to the EU, is going to be at the heart of the European Union. And I think the solidarity of how other countries talk about Ireland and the Irish question, I think, shows that. So if you're an investor looking to access the EU, which is the most valuable consumer market on the planet, Ireland is a good place to do that from. It will be even more a gateway, I think, now into the EU. It will be effectively the only English-speaking country. Cork is the second largest English-speaking city. Great place to rest.
What about Cambridge?
Yeah, it's probably in the top 10. if you look at foreign direct investment for a while, I mean, first of all, and I think a lot of US companies have understood this for quite a while, they have a footprint in both the UK and Ireland. They just deal in the same market. So if you look at a big pharmaceutical company, you know, a lot of their manufacturing facilities may be either in Ireland or the UK, but it could be they could be producing component parts for products on either side of the Irish Sea, and that's just a seamless manufacturing research innovation platform. All of a sudden now, the UK side of that is potentially outside of all of the rules and standards and certainty that the EU provides. All of a sudden there may be talents in terms of simply bringing product to and from manufacturing facilities on the inside of the Irish Sea. All of a sudden, a workforce in Ireland that's not Irish may well have to require a work permit to simply go and do a job as part of their network in the UK. What's called a common travel area means that Irish and British people will be able to live and work and study in both countries, regardless of that. But that doesn't cover all the other nationalities that are part of the Irish economy. So what I would say is that we know that in the UK, we've been the most successful country at attracting foreign direct investment in the EU. That half of that investment, roughly, has been about targeting the UK domestic consumer, and the other half has been about using the UK as a platform both into the rest of the EU and further afield. And it's that other 50% that I think now we'll be looking elsewhere. And I think Ireland will be a very attractive proposition because of the formula that we know works, thanks to the IA and others, and the work we're doing. So one of the predictions, actually, in the context of Brexit, deal or no deal, is that foreign direct investment has contributed to the Irish economy will get even stronger. This is part, I think, of the challenge of Brexit from a British perspective, but I just don't believe it makes sense. If you want to be more globalised, if you want more global trade, the idea that you move away from the certainty of the EU in terms of the regulatory environment and the 57 trade arrangements that the EU has around the world, you can't start again. And that's somehow good for trade. I just don't get it. But from an Irish perspective, we're doing all that. We're staying where we are. We're going to be part of the EU. And a single market. That poses huge challenges for us in the context of the border issues on the island of Ireland in terms of remaining part of the EU single market and protecting its integrity. But the message is clear from us to business. Ireland stays open for business. It's part of the EU. It's part of the single market and customs union. It's part of that certainty in terms of regulatory environment and that barrier-free access into a huge consumer base. And I think that would be a very persuasive proposition in terms of investment in the future.
I'm going to bundle some questions. Adrian Jones here first, and then Mark McAlvin over here. I expect two slightly different questions.
I'm not even going to ask a question. I'm going to make a comment just an observation, in our chat, I will share a compliment and a slight criticism in the same. First of all, the compliment. I think one of Ireland's advantages at this moment in time is that I'm not making a political point there, but in my lifetime, this is the most successful Irish government that we've had. It's also, this part you say it's very young. It's a young government. It's very impressive, articulate, intelligent government. And we're very fortunate to have a government like this at this time. It's just this government isn't spending enough time in New York. Not the U.S., in New York. In the Kennedy 2011 through 2017, one thing he got right was coming over. He loves coming, but he's very grateful and very happy. And then when you come over, there's a lot of demand on your time. You can speak to the fire, and that's great. But this is the fire. We're all in. You need to be in boardrooms. You need to be doing media. We can help influence opinions, but we're now playing to an advantage, to our advantage of the country, which is the present government doesn't have a strategy around the ego. This is the really matters for us, not just in our will over the coming years. So I would encourage you as a government to think tactically and strategically about it. And there's many of you who come over here to do impressive jobs. Let it not just be coming over and going to the same groups and flying the flag and pushing to the choir. There have to be ways of opening up your schedules and getting into the boardroom and on media. And I'm sure you do a lot of this, but not as a group.
Yes, I work with the HR at my guardians, and we do a great deal of work with victims groups in the North. That's one of the key issues that is at the heart of nothing, and we get back to sort of And first of all, I want to commend you personally and the government for the work that you've done in getting Legacy Justice. And I haven't always been able to say that about our Irish foreign minister and government, but I certainly can say it about you personally and this government. And just curious and concerned, is the Stormont House Agreement 5 years old? No moves towards implementing it. There doesn't seem to be any moves towards implementing it. Your NAB moves is part of the same attitudes which we see with Boris Johnson in terms of Brexit. He's appointed a minister who seems like there might be moves towards amnesty towards British troops to stop them from being prosecuted of murders in places like Ballymurphy and elsewhere. And I know that's one of the key factors that concerns a great many people in the North, the key factor that preventing the institutions from going up. And can you tell us what you can do in the Irish government just to get Stormont House Agreement, which was agreed so long ago, implemented, and just do anything in terms of getting justice for people, legacy groups in the North Department?
Yeah. First of all, you're right. We're not in New York enough. We're not in the U.S. enough, even though we actually have what I would regard on paper as probably the most ambitious Irish-U.S. strategy we've ever had. We just launched a new North American strategy. It involves opening up, new consulates, a big investment in the arts, creating Ireland houses, insisting on bringing over a lot more Irish politicians, not just at the top of government, but from the office generally to different US cities. It involves a lot more reach out away from Washington to political structures within states. It's really good, actually. But that's not the point you're making. The point you're making is that the Taoiseach and myself and people like Helen and others really spending more time here actually getting to know people and reinforcing a message around the importance of Irish America and our influence and interest here. I think it's a fair criticism of me that I haven't travelled as much as the Foreign Minister should generally. I would say that about Helen. I do travel a lot, but there's a reason for it. It's because I'm a tarnished as well, and because Brexit has just been so all-consuming that I think the Taoiseach needs me in Ireland more than he would normally in terms of managing message with it. So I spend a lot of time in Belfast, a lot of time in London, a lot of time in Dublin and Brussels. I'll get Brussels again on Friday. We'll probably be in Belfast again in the next few days. I've virtually been in Belfast every week for the last 100 months. At some point. Certainly every second week. So, normally, I think if we didn't have the pressure from Brexit, if we didn't have collapsed institutions in the North, I would be spending a lot more time in the US, I think, and in the other parts of the world. Big interest in the Middle East. And we spent close to €800 million of Irish taxpayers' money across Africa each year as well, in terms of development assistance and so on. But effectively, I have become almost a minister for Brexit as well as a minister for foreign affairs. So if we can get Brexit settled, I think you will see people like me and others spending a lot more time over here. I'd like to do that and be challenged by ensuring that we are essentially bringing a new generation of Irish Americans into the space of understanding what modern Ireland is trying to be, how we're trying to reach out, so on. On the legacy issue, legacy is a massive, massive issue in the North. We have tried to a certain extent, not separate, but at least kind of compartmentalize legacy, because if we try to solve all the legacy issues in the context of reestablishing an executive of the institutions, we make it a much, much more difficult task. So we're trying to do the two in parallel, as opposed to finalizing legacy first before executive, in terms of structure, because don't forget, the Stormont House Agreement and the commitments in it require the British government to introduce quite a lot of legislation. And given the makeup of the British government at the moment, the fact that they don't have a majority, virtually any legislation is hard to get passed. Never mind controversial legislation where there's a lot of division within the Conservative Party in particular, but within Westminster generally, on issues like statutes of limitation for soldiers serving serving Northern Ireland and so on. But let me just be clear, the Irish position is crystal clear on these issues. There is no amnesty catered for in Stormcast, or for that matter, in the context of legacy and the Friday Agreement. And if we're going to have an honest approach to legacy, we've got to accept that there needs to be legacy requests all around. And if there was wrongdoing, it needs to be shown up with families and deserve the truth. The vast majority of those requests will involve paramilitaries and terrorist activity and attacks. Many of them absolutely shocking. But some of them will also involve soldiers and police officers in Northern Ireland. And we will insist on that approach and the commitments that Stormont House can follow through on. But otherwise, I think the commitment to legacy from communities who are emotionally attached to this, I think will collapse and break down. We've got to avoid that. So British government has to stay strong here in terms of the commitments that it has made in Stormont House. We obviously encourage that and supporting that approach, but I think it's important to recognise as well the challenge that any Secretary of State has in terms of getting legislation passed in Westminster at the moment is really, really difficult. And if you speak to Julie Smith, if you speak to Karen Bradley before her, or James Robichaud before Karen Bradley, getting legislation through on legacy, particularly as it relates to soldiers in Northern Ireland, is a very controversial debate in the UK right now. But our position is clear and firm. There's a responsibility here. Commitments have been made and signed up to the Stormont House and we've gone through on it.
Just to add to that, obviously, the challenges that Brexit brings, one of the main priorities, because it's just prevent the reintroduction of border infrastructure, but there are obviously other challenges, and in particular, we have a very successful peace and reconciliation programme through the European Union, which is co-funded by our government with the UK and the EU. Obviously, in the event of a no deal, that then is threatened. What we've been working on, and ourselves with the Minister for Finance and other ministers, is to ensure that that funding, which supports along with other supports ourselves and others provide, allow significant type of programmes specifically focused on peace reconciliation, historical issues between communities to continue, and that's something that I think we have agreement with the UK on, so that's something called Peace Plus, which we've now agreed with the Commission, will continue to respect of what happens. So I think even things like that are extremely important in the context of Brexit and the challenges that it
has. Yeah, and I think the Irish government's responsibilities as well in terms of legacy, by the way, and I think we are following through on that. We've introduced legislation, which is a first, that actually, if there's an inquest in Northern Ireland, a former or current member of the Irish Economy can contribute to that inquest, which legally is in the state, through the High Court of Dublin, through a new piece of legislation that Mr. Charlie Flanagan has introduced, which is a way of trying to reassure that states predominantly Unionist families who may have been victims of atrocities in the past, that if there are questions to be asked across the border, that actually that can be facilitated now through a new political structure, which is a very complicated piece of legislation to introduce, but Charlie Flanagan has done that. So we are, I think, playing our part in terms of following through on our commitments, and the British government needs to do the same in terms of setting up a historical investigations unit and the legal foundation to come for a lot of structures that were agreed in Stormcast.
Josh, I'm just going to have one quick round of questions. There are a few people with their hands up with it. Yvonne Bendier Rothschild is from the European American Chamber of Commerce, followed by Manus McGuire, followed by Kieran McLaughlin back there, and lastly by Angus Miller. And I'd say this, Josh, the timetable, I'd say we're done at that point. Before I hand over the microphone to Yvonne, I should flag it. It wasn't announced earlier, we have Ambassador Daniel Hall up here also from Washington, D.C.
But I think I was going to ask you a different question, but I think you answered it. I would like to pick up on what the gentleman to my left said. It's utterly important for not only the Irish government, but for all European governments to talk about Brexit and to talk about what we're doing in the European Union, in the United States. The Americans believe that Brexit is something that is happening in Europe. Brexit is almost not happening in Europe. It's happening, it's a triangulation. It will very much influence the relationship between the United States and Europe and the United States and the United Kingdom. I mean, the UK used to be a stepping stone to Europe. Now it's going to be a stepping stone to nowhere again, and everything. So we absolutely need all European governments to be here and talk more about Europe to the business community. So I asked it in a second question. But my question is, I'm picking up on two things you said, time all-consuming and kicking the can down the road. How many more extensions are we going to give the British government without asking for something back in return? I mean, we ask them to make suggestions to certain things that they don't like about the agreement, but I've actually sat through the sessions in the House of Commons and started yelling at the television. They have said no to everything. There's nothing left to say no to, and that's when they got themselves a new prime minister. How can we speed up this process? We can't continue this forever. We need to find a resolution to it, and somebody needs to come stand up and say, you know, you're out. I would like to hear your take on that.
Thanks very much for your time this morning, Thomas Chandler. I work for a company called First Rivers, and we're a UK public listed company. Where our headquarters are in Newry, one of the towns that you mentioned in your address this morning, Marshall. My question, I'm from County Clare, and my question is really about how you address mobility of labour, access to public services for young people that are looking at the United Kingdom and abroad for new educational challenges, ways to venture for career development. Like I have, what assurances can you give to young people of Ireland? We're looking at trying to advance their careers over the board.
Jerome? Thanks for Mr. Cosby. A very good question. Are you detecting any shifting in attitudes at the popular level and the political level within unionism based on the dire predictions from the security services and economic sources, etc., of the impact of a no deal? And if that does occur, will it be enough to soften attitudes at a Westminster level, as sort of national Australia within the what is, after all, the Conservative Unionist Party?
And this will show the microphone to get.
Thank you, John. I work for PBS, and PBS has a big footprint in the UK, and they've been starting to move a lot of stuff overseas. And I guess my question to you is, it looks like more common that a hard Brexit is going to be a lot more obvious than it probably was. And with that impact, does the government have any scope as to what that financial impact is going to look like? And also, what is the government doing to alleviate that financial impact for the Ireland and adjust the relationship between the US and Ireland in that respect?
Maybe I'll just go back to front and maybe the answers are first. First of all, the financial impact of an no-deal Brexit would be significant. We think we issue as a government every year what's called a summary economic statement, so it's kind of a precursor to the budget, which will happen 2 weeks back, by the way. And what we did in that summary economic statement was to put an estimate in place of what a no-deal Brexit looks like financially for the country in terms of reduced revenue, loss of confidence, increased expenditures to support vulnerable sectors like agriculture and tourism, trying to factor in the impact of devaluation of sterling. Basically, what would be the impact on Ireland's balance sheet of a no-deal Brexit? And the estimate is about €6 billion a year in terms of the first year. I'm glad to say that the Irish economy can now have managed that. We need to. We probably wouldn't have been able to a decade ago. But we now have a very strong economy. Our GDP ratio has improved. We are running a modest surplus in terms of our budget now. So effectively what it means is that we would probably go from modest surplus to modest deficit. We would have to borrow some money. We have spoken to the markets about that, and I think they have a lot of confidence that we'll be able to manage the consequences of our deal. But make no mistake, this is very disruptive. We have made the decision of the government, and Mr. Donoghue Pascal has made the decision that we are going to design a budget in 2 weeks' time around the no deal. So we're taking a pessimistic, cautious approach that we have to budget for our worst-case scenario. That means this will be a very different budget to normal. We'll be making choices to put a lot of money aside to support vulnerable sectors of both society and our economy that may be impacted by no deal and the changed trade environment in the UK. I mean, for those of you who don't know, we have 70 billion euro East-West trade relationship with the UK. 38,000 Irish companies trade with the UK every week. 92,000 Irish companies traded with the UK at some level last year. That's a lot of people of a workforce of just over 2 million. So while we only export 14% of our exports to the UK, 44% of our exports to the rest of the EU, those figures kind of disguise the fact that for a lot of small businesses and others, there's a huge reliance on the British market, the British consumers, and the British consumers. And of course, we import huge volumes as well from the UK. We are Britain's largest market for food and drink, for example, nearly 4 billion euros a year. So it will have very disruptive impact on certain sectors of the economy, and we are factoring that in and putting a budget together to respond to that. Having said that, I still believe we can avoid a review, but we have to apply a precautionary principle because of, quite frankly, the political chaos that we're dealing with. In some ways, Brexit is slightly moving target, but just so you've really got a hold of it, we'll move to a different place in terms of approach or questions that need to be answered because of the change in British approach to a number of things. Kieran's question on the response to media is, I need to be really careful with that. Whatever I say about media is often it's taken the wrong way. So I'm very slow to say anything. Apart from to say that I believe that the two unionist parties in Northern Ireland, the DUP and the EU, both want to avoid MOT. They both see the dangers of that. Nobody wants to be blamed for it. And so I do think they are searching for solutions. And we need to be generous in terms of how we respond to that and try to help that process. But that doesn't mean that we sign up to solutions that don't work, because it's very convenient to do it. So we've got to start from the position of effectively having an independent assessment of any proposed solution on the border question. It's got to work. It's not up to scrutiny. And deliver the outcome that we know the backstop does. If we can find other approaches or variants of that that provide the same outcome, I hope we can find a way to do that that you need to communicate with as well as everybody else. But I do believe they're searching and trying. And in fact, I think God said yesterday that, you know, the Brexit chapter may move beyond the end of October now. Because, I think that again is an indication that they, as well as everybody else, wants to try and avoid a no deal, apart from some. The British government seem to be comfortable with a no deal, but I think the majority aren't. Mobility. Okay, so the answer to that is a very positive one. So we, as part of our contingency planning, we have what's called a travel area arrangement with the UK. I signed a memorandum of understanding with the Minister, who was then essentially the fact that we can access the UK. And what that means is that Irish people, regardless of Brexit, deal or no deal, in the future will be able to travel to, study, work in, access social welfare, carry pensions, essentially be treated almost as a British national in the UK, and British citizens in Ireland do the same. that common travel area was in place between Britain and Ireland since the 1920s. And we've reinforced that now, regardless of the outcome of Brexit. The problem, of course, is if you're a French or a Dutch or a Spanish person living in Ireland, the CTA, as it's called, from travel area arrangements, only apply if you're an Irish passport holder in the UK or a UK passport holder in Ireland. Essentially, it's been hugely helpful in terms of problem in Northern Ireland question as well in terms of voting. So from a people movement and career point of view, if you're an Irish passport holder, you can continue to go to college in the UK, study there, and all the other things that you enjoy. But as I say, it doesn't solve the problem with any of the other nationalities that are very much part of Irish society. The extension. Well, for us, an extension is better than no deal. I think the EU is getting increasingly impatient, but in certain countries in particular, I think will be quite reluctant to agree to even a 3-month extension at the end of January, which is what British governments may be required to apply for by law if they can't get a deal. My sense is, though, that if there was a good reason for the extension to be facilitated, i.e. an election, for example, or something else that could fundamentally change the paradigm here, if you like, in terms of getting an outcome that avoids an ordeal, then I would be hopeful that we can win the arguments along with others to facilitate that. But I can only speak from an Irish perspective, other countries will speak for themselves. And of course this will need to get agreement across all leaders. But the consequences of an ordeal are serious for everybody, particularly for the UK and for Ireland, but serious for everybody else too. I think people will want to avoid that if they can. But there are some countries who are now starting to say, actually, the cost of uncertainty linked to Brexit is now becoming as expensive or more expensive in terms of political capital and so on, as well as actually financial cost, of actually continuing this circular discussion that's not coming to an end. And a binary choice is now required. You know, here's a deal, take a leave. I don't think that argument will win the day, but if there is a real effort in the British political system to try to find a way forward, either through an election or something means. But look, I haven't given up on getting a deal in October, not by a long shot. I think it's doable. I think there is a really crucial 10-day window after the Conservative Party conference that starts on Sunday and finishes Wednesday. There's a 10-day period after that before the European Council on the 17th. That's the window. And I think, despite all the discussion and talk and commentary, I think the British government knows, they certainly know the parameters anyway of what's required for a deal. And it's really a question of political will as to whether they want to move there. And I think the EU wants to be as helpful as they possibly can be to make that process work. But ultimately, this is the British government's decision. If it's a no deal, and the British government has decided that that is the course of action that they're pursuing, and it'll be a British Parliament that is allowed to happen. But I hope that doesn't happen. But anyway, I do so. I can't emphasize enough the role that we have tried to play as a government in terms of building the solidarity that allows us to speak like this, knowing that the EU has got our back. It's just extraordinary that countries like France and Germany and Spain and Italy, the big four that are remaining, I suppose, all these countries want to deal with the UK. Of course they want to deal. But none of them have put any pressure on Ireland to essentially compromise in a way that puts huge pressure on us. I just think it's an extraordinary example of what the European Union is today, that actually a small country, we're in the spotlight, we don't want to be. We are preventing a deal being done, not because we're being stubborn, because the issue is so complicated. And nobody on the EU side is saying, look, enough is enough, let's go deal. They're saying, and it's a, it's, and I think one of the things that is not understood is that for many countries, this is a test of actually what the European Union is about in the future. That actually, you know, in 10 years' time, this could be Lithuania, or it could be Cyprus, or it could be Estonia, because of the threat from the east, or from migration, or from, and, you know, does a small country in trouble matter to everybody else? And I think the Brexit test of that is an emphatic yes. And that is why this idea that somehow the British government just puts more and more and more pressure on Dublin to compromise, that somehow we just say, well, let's put this thing off and cut a deal there for the convenience now of getting a deal. I just think it's such a misreading of where we are. We want to be generous, we want to be flexible, we want to be healthy. But our issue has got to be resolved. And I think if the British government understands that, we can get a deal done. If they don't accept that, well then, this goes into, whether it's extended or not, it moves into a very uncertain place.
I'm getting very subtle signals from your team.